One last statement here from Jefferson U, better known now as Rape U. Quote, this is from the article, at UVA, that's the University of Virginia, rapes are kept quiet, both by students who brush off sexual assaults as regrettable but inevitable casualties of their cherished party culture, and by an administration that critics say is less concerned with protecting students than it is with protecting its own reputation from scandal. What other large public institution routinely fails to disclose sexual abuse cases and is less concerned with their constituency than they are protecting their own image and reputation from scandal? How about the Roman Catholic Church? So, universities have something in common with the Roman Catholic Church. Not only a propensity for sexual abuse to occur, and numbers that exceed the sexual abuse coefficient found in society as large, but an environment where it's covered up. Ah, where's another institution, large institution, where sexual abuse is prevalent, vastly more prevalent, in this case, 8 times more prevalent than it is in society at large, and where prosecutions of sexual misconduct are less than 1% of cases where someone has been victimized? The U.S. military. So the U.S. military, the Roman Catholic Church, and universities across America all share this in common. Not only an environment where women in particular, but in the case of the military, it's also men, are far more likely to be abused sexually, but where the institutions themselves are predisposed to cover up the crime, recognizing that by doing so, they will somehow preserve their cherished reputation, but make ever more individuals vulnerable. It's what has happened to our mentality. The first casualty of this story, whether it is true or not, ought to have been Teresa Sullivan. Former New York mayor and general nincompoop Rudy Giuliani, another one of the idiots that ran for president, faced immediate web backlash Sunday morning after asked why people protest the killing of unarmed, why the people would protest the killing of unarmed Ferguson, Missouri teenager Michael Brown, but not black-on-black crime. Now, first of all, we really ought to stop talking about Michael Brown being unarmed. If you are talking about him being unarmed, A, then you are ignorant of his previous violence at the convenience store where he assaulted the shop owner. And B, you're ignorant of the police officer's claim that he tried to steal his gun. So, this unarmed boy is stupid. But the question is interesting. Why are people protesting the killing of Michael Brown? And I'm not sure he's dead, so it's a killing, but it's certainly not a murder. Based on the evidence I've seen, it's not a murder. But not black-on-black crime. This is what Giuliani said. 93% of blacks are killed by other blacks, triggering a heated argument on NBC's Meeting Press. I'd like to see the attention paid to that you're paying to this. Now, 93% is a pretty high number. Now, Giuliani was a prosecutor prior to being the mayor of New York City. I'm not challenging his number. I mean, I knew and have read the FBI statistics that say that if a white and a black are victim and perpetrator of a violent crime, rape, murder, armed robbery, that in the case of those violent and serious crimes that are interracial, that the white individual is 8 times more likely to be the victim of a black perpetrator than the other way around. That's a serious problem. But, you know, 8 times isn't 93%, so perhaps he has access to more recent numbers, and he's just saying that and that's different. This is same race crime, race on race, as opposed to race against race, interracial crime. And he's saying that if a black individual like Michael Brown is killed, that 93% of the time he's killed by a fellow black. Now, that's an interesting statistic. And I would tell you that if it's true, and I have no reason to suspect it's not, based on the other things that I have read from the FBI and the Justice Department, it's still not as important as black-on-white crime. If you're going to protest an interracial crime, in this case, which you think is a crime, of a white officer shooting a black shoplifter, then you ought to do so recognizing that it is 8 times more likely to be the other way around. And until it becomes skewed against blacks, where they are the victim more often than the perpetrator of interracial crimes, you ought not be protesting them, period. And that really is the rational comparison that Giuliani should have made, is that, you know, if you're going to protest interracial crime, then you really ought to be fair and to say, we have a real problem in the African-American community. We're 8 times more likely to attack and kill a Caucasian than a Caucasian is to kill an African-American. But he chose just black-on-black crime. Now, that's also interesting. Georgetown professor Michael Dyson, a frequent MSNBC pundit, said Giuliani was applying a false equivalency to the situation in Ferguson, where the grand jury will soon decide whether to charge Darren Wilson. I would agree. I think it is, well, it's an interesting comparison. It's a false equivalency. The proper equivalency is virtually identical in terms of its importance, and that is black-on-white gun crime. 8 times more likely that a black is going to pull a gun and shoot and kill a white than the other way around. That is absolutely unassailable and comparable. Then this is the pundit, who is the professor, says, black people who kill black people go to jail. White people who are policemen who kill black people do not go to jail. What a piece of crap Dyson is. No wonder the media likes him. In actuality, when a black individual in a inner city kills another black individual in inner city, it is very often gang-related crime. It's very often over turf as it relates to their jurisdiction to sell drugs, to manage prostitutes. That's typically the environment. Or it's a drive-by so that you can prove your worthiness to be part of the gang. Or some gang member feels insulted by some rival gang member, and he sends his gang out to shoot and kill them. the perpetrator is no more likely to go to jail in that circumstance than any other. There is no statistic that says that black on black violence yields a higher incarceration rate than does white on black violence. Matter of fact, all of the long-term studies show that when an African-American is brought to trial for murder, that they are less likely to be convicted than is the Caucasian. So, you know, here's thousands of cases over decades of time in America, and the studies of those cases show that it is less likely, actually, that the black perpetrator will go to jail than a white perpetrator. The only place where justice doesn't appear to be or could be inappropriate in favor of the Caucasian against the black, because what I've just shared with you would be the opposite of what Dyson, the professor, said. And that is that for the same crime, convictions on and sentences against black perpetrators average about 10% longer than for white perpetrators. So if you take the same wide swath of time and scope, and you recognize that blacks are 10% less likely to be convicted, but blacks who are convicted are likely to spend 10% more time in jail, you really have an offset under those circumstances. And the offset is way too narrow on both sides. The 10% more likely to be convicted, and the convicted individual's sentencing being 10% longer. Even though it is statistically relevant, the offset, and it's a very minor number compared to 93% and 8 times. So, Mr. Dyson, you're a fool. Speaking of sexual abuse, in Jakarta, Indonesia, and Indonesia is about 90% Muslim, the Indonesian police are continuing to use a degrading, invasive physical test to check for female recruits' virginity. This, according to Human Rights Watch. A manual examination is used to physically check for an intact hymen in the recruits. It is, according to the report, a long-standing part of the health check that women must undergo to be accepted into the Jakarta police force. While the virginity test is not specifically part of the required genealogy examination that female recruits are required to undergo to gain entry into the national police, senior female officers told the report's authors that it has been part of the process for a very long time, and there is no chance that it will go away. Now you tell me, under what bizarre circumstances would someone's virginity be the basis of a test for a job? I mean, that would preclude, of course, all married women. So if you're married, you can't be a police officer if you're a woman. It's just part of the degrading and disgusting influence of Islam. Pentagon officials this past week denied that they paid a ransom for the release of Army Sergeant Bo Bergdahl. Boy, you haven't heard peep from him, have you? Now, here was a guy that the U.S. military didn't want talking. Now, his written statements where he was disgusted by America's behavior in Afghanistan and just wanted out. But when you join the U.S. military, you can't get out. Now, this idea that he left his fellow soldiers more vulnerable, no, he didn't. They were all huddling behind the barricades of their camp, and he simply walked out. Well, some U.S. military died trying to capture him. Well, he left a note that says, I'm out of here. I just don't want to be part of this anymore. If they were trying to capture him, they were trying to capture him not for his safety, but because the military wants to prosecute anyone who demonstrates any personal freedom. And so they were going to incarcerate him, and yeah, they stupidly lost lives trying to track him down so they could throw him in jail. And then the U.S. government, which says you can't negotiate with and pay a ransom to terrorists, which is how Islam has used kidnapping now for 1,400 years. It's all part of a financial scheme to kidnap individuals and turn them back over when the ransom is paid. Well, the United States doesn't allow that, which is why the Americans are typically beheaded with the large Islamic terrorist organizations. The Frenchmen and others are typically returned home safely, and the Americans are typically killed. That's what America likes, because then we can justify going to war, I guess. But here in the Bergdahl case, we traded five senior Afghani Taliban officers, all of whom we had evidence had participated in mass executions of civilians. And we released those five for this one man who simply sought his freedom, who was being treated extraordinarily well by his captors, playing badminton with him and, you know, reading books, having tea, sharing meals. And now there's suspicion that in addition to trading bodies, lives, captives, that the U.S. government also provided money, breaking its own law that it prevents civilians from doing. Rear Admiral John Kirby, the Pentagon press secretary, told reporters that no ransom was offered or paid. Now, that's not true. You paid a human ransom for him. But he says that no dollar ransom was offered or paid. Nor was there any attempt to do so that failed to gain the release of Bergdahl, 28, who was held captive by the Taliban from June 2009 through May. Kirby was less adamant, however, on whether money was provided to an alleged informant who claimed to have knowledge of where the soldier was being held. I am not aware that any money changed hands, Kirby said, but acknowledge that the U.S. military occasionally pays informants. Yeah, we do all the time. Very common. What's the difference? You may recall that a couple of months ago, the United States expanded its drone murder campaign. And it's murder, by the way, because it's premeditated. Civilians are being killed. And the belligerent is knowingly and willingly stalking them and killing them. And there is absolutely no trial. No evidence is brought to bear against them. There is no indictment. There's no defense. There's no lawyers. There's no judge. There's no jury. There is no trial. It's murder. I mean, there is no other way to define what the United States is doing with its drone. We've murdered 5,000 civilians. We haven't killed a single military officer. I'm not sure we've even murdered anyone who has ever previously attacked and killed an American. But nonetheless, our murderous drone campaign was expanded beyond, and I assume it was drones, but might have been, you know, the old-fashioned aircraft, from Yemen, where we're pretty active, Pakistan, where we're very active, into Somalia. And in Somalia, our target was a fellow that he's not real fond of non-Islamic Somalians and non-Islamic Kenyans and non-Islamic Tanzanians. But to my knowledge, really hasn't had much to do with America. Anyway, we decided that the Obaminator decided I'm going to go kill him. And we did. We killed him. You know, so the head of the lads in Somalia, it's Al-Shabaab, the lads, the Islamic club for wayward Muslim boys, was killed. Ah, that should be the end of Al-Shabaab, right? Yeah, well, not so right. Gunmen from the Somali militant group Al-Shabaab, and this would be actually gun boys, say they have attacked a bus in northern Kenya and murdered 28 people. The bus was traveling to the capital, Nairobi, when it was stopped not far from the Somali border. Gunmen separated out non-Muslims by asking the passengers to read from the Quran, officials said. Those who failed were then shot at point-blank range in the head. You know, Ben, if you're listening, Ben Affleck, if you're listening to this, Ben, pretty hard to distinguish this from Islam, isn't it? The test for whether or not we're going to blow your brains out. Your crime is you're riding on a bus. And we're going to blow your brains out unless we like the way you read from the Quran, the worst book ever written. How do you distance these murders from Islam? Ben? Al-Shabaab has carried out a series of attacks in Kenya since 2011. A statement on a website linked to the Islamic group carried a statement saying that the attack was carried out in retaliation for security raids on mosques in the coastal city of Mombasa earlier this week. Yes, the Kenyans determined that the mosque had supplied the jihadist and the weapons that were deployed in the shopping center that killed, 250 innocent civilians were murdered. And that the mosques were continuing to inspire, train, and arm jihadists. So the police went into the mosques to prevent them from arming, training, and inspiring jihadists. And guess what they found in the mosques? Semi-automatic weapons, grenades, and documents designed to train and motivate Islamic jihadists. And so the Muslims went berserk. Even the head of their version of CARE, you know, here it's the Organization for Islamic American Relations. And they, all of the imams and the civil rights activists says, how dare you single out Muslims and attack a mosque? Well, you know, if the mosque is not the source of the jihadists, not the source of the weapons, then we ought not have found these things in the mosques. But at the time, the Muslims went berserk, and they, to prove how violent they are, they attacked civilians with hatchets and with machetes and with pistols. Now, to show how peaceful they are and to prove that raiding the mosque was the right thing to do despite the angered protests from Islamic clerics, they hijacked a bus and they systematically murdered everyone who wasn't a Muslim, blowing off their heads. Kenya's interior minister said on his Twitter feed that a camp belonging to the attackers had been destroyed by the Kenyan military helicopters, jets, with many killed. One of the passengers on the bus, Ahmad Mahat, told the BBC that there were more than 60 passengers on board when it was attacked before dawn. When he said about 10 heavily armed men speaking in Somali ordered the passengers off the bus. When we got down, passengers were separated according to Somali and non-Somalis. The non-Somalis were ordered to read some verses from the Holy Quran. Those who failed were ordered to lie down. One by one, they were shot in the head at point-blank range, end quote. Some Somalis were shot after pleading with the gunman to spare the non-Somali passengers. The Kenya's Red Cross said emergency workers were trying to retrieve the bodies from the scene. Security agencies were in pursuit of the criminal gang, the Muslims, who carried out the attack. It described the assailants not as Muslims, however, not as jihadists, not as mujahideen, but as bandits. They didn't rob anyone. This was all about cold-blooded murder. Speaking of murderers, the black flag of the Islamic State flies over government buildings. This is Dateline CNN. Police cars carry the group's insignia. The local football stadium is used for public executions. A town in Syria or Iraq? No. No. It's a city on the coast of the Mediterranean in Libya. Oh, thank you, John McClown. You wanted to go bomb Tripoli. You wanted to provide weapons to those freedom fighters in Libya so they could go kill Muammar Gaddafi. And what'd you get? You got the black flag of the Islamic State flying over the local football stadium, flying over the government buildings. Yep, you got Muslims in Libya. Oh, but thank God they're not swearing their allegiance to Muammar Gaddafi, that pathetic syphilitic. No, instead, they're aligned with the Islamic State. Nice job, John. You should be so proud of yourself. Fighters loyal to the Islamic State and are now in complete control of the city of Derna, a population of about 100,000, not far from the Egyptian border, and just about 200 miles from the southern shores of the European Union. Oh, John, you are so clever. You should be so proud of yourself. The sources say that the Derna branch of the Islamic State counts 800 fighters and operates half a dozen camps on the outskirts of town, as well as larger facilities in the nearby Green Mountains where its jihadists come from northern Africa and are trained. It has been bolstered by the return to Libya from Syria and Iraq of up to 300 Libyan jihadists who were part of the Islamic State. They were part of the Batar Brigades, deployed at the at first in Deir ez-Zor, Syria, and then in Mosul, Iraq. These jihadists, the very folks that America armed in Libya before they joined the Mujahideen in Syria, supported the Shura Council for the Youth of Islam, which is a pro-Islamic State faction. Yes, the Shura Council for the Youth of Islam. And you want us to believe, Obaminator, that the Islamic State is not Islamic? The council had been competing for superiority with other Islamic militant groups, the Abu Salem Brigade, some of whose fighters' loyalties lie with Al-Qaeda, according to Norman Ben Othman, a former Libyan journalist now involved in counterterrorism for the Kulim Foundation. Let me tell you something, folks. There isn't a single jihadist in Libya whose loyalties lie with al-Qaeda in the sense of Osama bin Laden's al-Qaeda. Not one. This isn't a fight for Muslim minds between al-Qaeda and the Islamic State. Al-Qaeda is absolutely irrelevant. This moron continues telling the media, al-Qaeda's top envoy in Libya, Abdul Best Azouz, left Derna after U.S. Special Forces captured Ahmed Abu Qatala, an alleged ringleader of the Benghazi attacks in June. Hey, let me tell you something, pals. Abu Qatala, which is drugs for Allah, Qatala, was the founder of and the head of Ansar Sharia, Friends of Sharia Law. He had no contacts with al-Qaeda. Before we return to the article whereby Libya is turned into the Islamic State, this out of Ferguson, Missouri. Schools were closed, barricades were erected, and stores were boarded up on Monday as a tense St. Louis suburb awaited word on whether charges will be filed against a white police officer who shot and killed a black teenager more than 3 months ago. Imagine that. A grand jury's decision as to whether or not to indict. The announcement of that was justification for closing schools, erecting barricades, and boarding up stores. Now, I'm going to tell you, since there's a 0% chance that whites are going to say, oh, my God, you indicted this man. We're going to go on the war path and let's go shoot a bunch of blacks. Then it must be that those who are in a position to know think that the African-American community is likely to disregard the whole nature and purpose of a grand jury, and that they're going to riot if he's not indicted. That speaks volumes about the lack of character in that community, their inability to exercise good judgment. You know, think about a grand jury for a moment. A grand jury is typically much larger than a typical jury. A typical jury is 12. A grand jury is usually in the range of 24 individuals. Their task is the opposite of the jury in a trial. In a jury in a trial, you're given instructions to convict only if the evidence is overwhelming. It has to be, the evidence has to prove beyond any reasonable doubt that the indicted individual committed the crime. With a grand jury, it's simply, is there enough evidence here to justify a trial? Is there a reasonable chance that with the evidence that has been provided, that a trial would yield a conviction? They aren't determining guilt. They're just determining whether or not there is even reason to suspect that a crime has been perpetrated. If after all of the weeks of evidence that they have been presented and have considered, if a simple majority of those 24 say, you know, we did not see sufficient evidence to suggest that a crime has been committed, then folks, there was no crime committed. Now, there's a lot of times where juries wrongly convict innocent individuals. There's lots of times where the Justice Department games the system and provides false testimony, the police themselves. There are all sorts of things that you ought to be concerned about in the trial system. But as it relates to a grand jury, if a grand jury isn't even willing to indict, then the likelihood that a crime has been committed that is even worthy of the of jurisprudence is nil. Why would you riot in those circumstances? And if they say, you know, we're going to indict him. And if it took all this time to make this decision, the case is really slim. Otherwise, they, I mean, because typically in a grand jury, a reporting officer will read the police report, will give a little history, and they'll say these are the reasons that it appears this individual may have committed this crime, and they will review 10 cases in an hour and say, yes, there's enough information there, charge them, no, there's not. For them to take weeks to determine whether or not this police officer reacted in self-defense. And when they're not trying to determine guilt, they're just trying to determine whether there's a possibility of a crime, it's thin. And if you're going to riot after that, something's tragically wrong with you. And if the grand jury decides they're going to indict just because they want to preclude riots, there's something seriously wrong with them. Now, the problem in America is that we are now restricting information. When you restrict information, people don't have the basis to exercise good judgment. And in this particular case, most of the information has been restricted. So there is no trial. We will never know what occurred. And that's wrong. And if there is a trial and an innocent man has to go and defend himself over a year, that's wrong too. The system is broken.